Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies.
As we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind.
From Ken Adam to Max Zorin, with occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. If you want to support the podcast, we have a coffee page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondAtoZ, and you can find the link in the show notes. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where M is for M, the head of the British Secret Service. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we take a look at the character of James Bond's boss, it's a man who also enjoys a spot of lepidoptery. It's Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hello.
And dialing in from his office in a half-sunken British ship in the Hong Kong harbour, it's Mr. Tom Wheatley.
Evening.
So four people have played M to date in 24 of the 25 so-called canon Bond films. They're a very crucial character in the tapestry of Bond, only not appearing in the film For Your Eyes Only, which I thought was quite interesting. Do you have a favourite incarnation of the character M?
Oh, yeah. The obvious one.
Bernard
the
Wright.
One.
Yeah. Brendan.
Yeah.
I mean, he's nodded.
It's Bernard Lee.
Well, I thought you might go for Judi Dench. I thought Dench might be.
No, my era. Look. Stop the golden-eyed japes now. there are only two M's in my eyes, though.
Oh, so, that's harsh.
It's harsh, but true.
Are you going to reveal them now?
Well, Bernard Lee and M. And M.
Bernard Lee and M. Lovely stuff.
Bernard Lee and Judi Dench.
Very good. Interesting character, like I said, very crucial to the story of Bond, and, you know, goes back as far as the Fleming books. I did toy with the idea of doing this introduction in the style of an M briefing, but nobody's got time for that, have they?
Not anymore.
You can't tell the listeners that you were going to do something that you couldn't be bothered.
I also toyed with the idea of reading out the lyrics from the Crash Test Dummy song, but again, target reference.
Yeah, it's not. That's tenuous, mate. That's tenuous.
So let's kick things off then with a look back at the origins of the character M.
So Ian Fleming, there's a recent film actually, Operation Mincemeat, which I think, have you both seen that?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
So the character who M is based on is actually in that film, Admiral John Godfrey, who was Fleming's naval intelligence officer superior during the Second World War. And yeah, he refers to him as M, but that's because he called his mum M, who was the most impossible, most terrifying, most demanding creature he ever met.
M for mother, I imagine.
M for mother. So that is one of the main influences, the heavy influences on the character of M. John Godfrey actually said after Ian Fleming died that he turned me into that unsavoury character M. So it doesn't sound like he was a fan of M.
Oh.
So, other inspiration, head of MI5, Maxwell Knight, signed his memos as M, who Ian Fleming was friends with. And the tradition within MI6, the head of MI6 signs with a single letter that came from somebody called Mansfield Smith Cumming, who signed his initial C. So that's where that stems from, and it's obviously something that continued moving forward and was a good thing to use when creating a character. And there's also another one, another further influence, somebody called William Melville, and he was head of the Secret Service Bureau, which was in place before MI5 and MI6. And again, Melville was referred to as M. So, yeah, there's a lot in there. But John Pearson, who wrote a Fleming biography, he leant heavily on the M for mother. Because Fleming, when he was young, one of the few people that Fleming really was sort of scared of and was stern towards him was his mum. So let's go with that. It seems mainly between Admiral John Godfrey and his mother. So there we go.
Interesting, because the M character in Avengers is called Mother.
Ah.
Not the Marvel film, the actual good series.
The Avengers.
Steed.
Yeah.
The Avengers, yeah. Yeah, they called him Mother.
Oh, and interesting that M becomes sort of a mother figure to him in the in the Daniel Craig era, doesn't he? Yeah. Doesn't she?
Yeah.
And I guess like the M character in a way is a surrogate parent to Bond, in that, you know, he's an orphan. So
yeah,
interesting that plays that part in them. Do you know what his name is in the books?
No.
It's Miles Messervy, is it?
Messervy. And he carries on throughout the books, I think, until... I think I've got this written down, but like as far as like the John Gardner era, I think, and then he retires. Raymond Benson introduced the female Bond. So, yeah, he's up to Colonel's son, I think, and also plays a part in the... Zero Minus Ten. So it's a long version of that character. So who's the first movie M?
Well, I don't think anyone listening to this is waiting on bated breath to find out who it is. Let's start with the big one. The Don, the Big Cheese, Bernard Lee. The Big Cheese. Bernard Lee, the first ever M on movie screens. I say that because I'm not entirely sure if there was an M in that original one. That
just go with Eon.
Eon, yeah, we'll go with Eon. So Bernard Lee is just a ridiculous character in terms of how many films he's been in and how impressive he was as an actor. I think it's quite difficult for people our age to see how big he was at the time and how much stuff he was in, because we've only really seen him in the Bond films and maybe a couple of sort of secondary roles that he played in other films. But he had a fantastic career. He was born in 1908, so a long, long time ago. And apparently he was in Brentford, but I also heard an account that it was in County Cork. I suppose when you're born that long ago, the records probably disappear. So his dad was an actor, and he introduced Bernard to the stage in a sketch called The Double Event, which was at the Oxford Music Hall when he was 6 years old. Got quite into that, and then he eventually joined RADA, like so many other actors that take part in the Bond series. And while he was there, he worked as a fruit porter to pay for the education that he had there. After that, he started working in theatre in Rusholme, Manchester and Cardiff. He worked on the West End, and he starred in a number of thrillers, one called Blind Man's Buff, which is sort of one of the more famous ones that he was in. He also played some comedic roles. So there was a play called 10 Minute Alibi, which he was in with Arthur Askey, which is interesting. I can't imagine those two together. But his screen debut was in a film called The Double Event, which is the same name as the first sketch he was in when he was six, which I thought I had to check that about three times because I thought I'd wrote it down wrong, but no, that is correct. Strange link there. And eventually he went into the war between 1940 and 1946. But before he went to war, he acted in a number of films that weren't released until quite a lot later, so they're released between 1939 and 1943, so his films are coming out while he was actually in the war. Those included Murder in Soho, The Frozen Limits, and Let George Do It. A lot of these films I have never heard of. I actually sat and looked through some trailers for a few of them. Some trailers don't exist for them because they're so old. But the last one, Let George Do It, was a George Formby film.
Ooh.
That he was in. So he served with Royal Sussex Regiment in the Second World War. And while he was waiting to be demobbed, and as we know, demobbed means leaving the army, he went to a golfing ladies' night, and he met the producer there who offered him a part in the play Stage Door. So back into the 1940s, after he'd finished in the war, he actually had a really... started to have a really successful film career, and he was in loads and loads of stuff. I'm not going to go through everything because, frankly, I don't know any of them, so I don't know which ones are important and which ones aren't. But yeah, he was in The Courtneys of Curzon Street, which was a major success and the biggest hit at the box office of 1947, so pretty nice early start for him. Other things, he was in The Third Man. He was in a film called Last Holiday, all the way going up to like the mid-1950s. Beat the Devil, Father Brown. And he tended to play a lot of sort of dependable characters, like policemen, officials, officers, just sort of suited men a lot of the time. And then he also was in a lot of war films, as you can imagine. He's playing colonels and commanders and people in charge of the war telling other people what to do, which largely probably led on to his casting in the Bond films, because that's essentially what he is. Apparently he appeared in over 100 films during his career, and in the 1950s he also did a lot more stage stuff. He was in a play called Seagulls Over Sorrento, and then he came back to do the film version of that later on with Gene Kelly. And he was in a film called Purple Plane with Gregory Peck. So he's worked with all of the greats of the golden era of cinema. He did a load of stuff. I won't go into any more of the films. Whistle Down the Wind, that's one that you might have heard of.
Yeah.
That was a really big film back in the start of the 60s. But in 1962, he was cast to play M in Bond. And he says about getting the role, he said that he knew Cubby, and he'd worked with him on Father Brown and Fire Down Below, along with Rita Hayworth, Robert Mitchum, Jack Lemmon and Herbert Lom. So sort of got it through that. Like Cubby knew who he was, and he'd seen what he can do, and he got the gig quite easily from that. According to some other people, there's a few sort of views on his role and how he did it. A lot of people said that he was very close to the Fleming version of M, which I can't remember him in the books, but is that accurate, would you say, Butler?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he sort of plays, it's like an admiral, former admiral, military type, quite stern, yeah, quite cold, but also like warm when he needs to be, you know, quite, yeah, like the relationship he has with Bond is, it feels, yeah, paternal in a way, but also in a military type way, you know, there's very strict boundaries.
Probably quite an easy character to pin down if you've been picked by having been seen in roles like that before. So,
well, it's interesting, yeah, isn't it? Because I was just thinking, like, who would be an equivalent of Bernard Lee now? And we don't really, I think because of the way that he came up, we don't really have actors like that anymore, do we? The sort of the stern military types, you know, no, the William Hartnell type actors, because we don't, the war is so long ago. So those, yeah, sorts of characters don't exist. Whereas in the 60s, 70s, they were a trope, right?
I'm trying to think of war equivalents these days that have got a sort of big commander in, but I can't think of anyone that's similar to Bernard Lee. Other people said that he was the incarnation of Fleming's crusty admiral, a real roast beef and Yorkshire pudding type of British actor, fits quite nicely, a paternal actor, and whilst he was embodying the role, a gruff, reliable, no-nonsense role character actor with kindly eyes, droll manner and expressly Anglo-Saxon level-headedness. That's probably right on the money, that one.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I'm not going to go into loads of depth about what he did in the films, because frankly, there's not a lot of information about him. When you're going this far back, there's not been interviews or anything. So just a rundown of the films he was in. So Dr. No, he was obviously one of the earliest scenes in it. And I think this is, when we talk about Dr. No, we talk about how it was very important for shaping the following films, and perhaps no more so than the scene with M, because that covers everything, that relationship he has with Connery. He's a bit stern with him, tells him off a few times, has the sort of debate with him about the gun, and Connery's sort of the child in that relationship and trying to be a bit naughty, tries to steal the gun. But he's also a very likable character. He's not like, he's not an angry military lead that's shouting at him. It's quite a warm scene as well, so it works very well, and I think they realized that straight away, and they probably saw that chemistry between Connery and M, because there's a lot of chemistry between those two when they're together in a room, which I'll come to later with Connery when he's playing against another M. And then so From Russia with Love, much of the same sort of idea. I think they've basically realized that worked, and they just sort of went with it again, gave him the information, had a bit of dialogue with him. I think he gets told off again in that one a few times. Then on to Goldfinger, where it's still pretty much the same sort of thing. Goldfinger, he actually gets a couple of scenes in there. I should probably point out that M doesn't get many actual... Probably is one of the... We've talked about Moneypenny before, but I'm not sure how many hours of actual film of M exist. It must be like 25 minutes or something across
like
the whole
thing. Yeah.
But yeah, so in Goldfinger, there's a nice scene where he goes to the office, and then he invites him Bond back later. So then we see in a group setting, as opposed to just being in the room with Bond. And it's when they're talking about the gold, and they're drinking wine, and Bond starts talking about
the brandy,
that's it. And then Mem says that Colonel Smithers is giving the lecture 007. Lovely little scene, because it I think that's important, because you see what M's like when there's other people there.
Yeah, I think also the scene in From Russia with Love where they're listening to Bond's tape that he's recorded with them.
Oh, of course, yes.
And there's that reference to something that him and M got up to on duty somewhere in the Far East. And that's quite a funny scene,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's a nice little addition, isn't it, to backstory. Thunderball sort of takes it up a notch again. They have this big scene where they're in a... I'm not sure what it is. It's like a war consulate, or sort of like a terrorism consulate, in a massive, beautiful room. And they're talking about the stolen nuclear warheads.
All the 00 agents get called in, don't they?
Bond is late,
yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. And that relationship is nice if you watch those two scenes, because then he goes back into the office with M and they sort of have a debrief together and talk about it. And he does actually change his tone a bit when he's in the group. He's very serious in the group setting. He just sort of wants to get it done, and then they have a little bit more of a discussion in the scene afterwards. So it's all building this fantastic relationship between the two in those first few films. And then in You Only Live Twice, things really heat up, because we get to see Bernard Lee in a little officer uniform on a submarine on location in what it looks like an enormous suite in this submarine, which is designed to look like his office in London, which I'm not sure how many submarines he had offices in.
Well, I love that gag. That gag is fantastic.
Because that submarine is also called M1 as well. So it suggests almost that the submarine is his own floating office.
Mm.
Which is great.
Dench never had one, did she?
No. Dench was hardly ever in her office.
No. So that brings us up to You Only Live Twice. But I probably should say at this point as well that he was also in OK Connery in 1967. So did a couple of Bond films around that time. And as well as that, he was also appearing in a lot of TV around that point as well. So he was in the obvious ones, Man in a Suitcase, Danger Man, and something called The Baron, which I've never seen. But very busy man up until that point for the way that he played a lot of those roles. And I did watch a few videos of him earlier. I think any time you've ever seen Bernard Lee in a film, it's either been Bond or you might have seen him as a supplementary character in a film where he plays a very similar sort of gruff, older guy. But he has done some quite interesting films where he doesn't play that role. Beyond This Place, and he plays a dad who's put into prison for killing his wife or something. So he's been a prisoner, and you see him after he's come out of prison, and that role is fantastic. I didn't realize it was him when I first watched and looked at it, because he's so different than you've seen him in the Bond films. And I also saw a couple of sort of romantic ones he was in as well, which was not a role I'd expect him to be in, but he's fantastic in them. He's actually probably at the time people knew this, but now he's, you know, you only know Bernard Lee because of the Bond films. But yeah, he was very versatile actor from what I've seen.
So as after You Only Live Twice, we get introduced to the second movie, M, in Casino Royale, the 1967 version. So now in this movie, John, we covered this when we covered Casino Royale 67 in an episode way back, but John Huston plays the role of M in Casino Royale. So as well as being the head of the Secret Service in that movie, he's also the laird of the Clan MacTarry, and he is killed right at the beginning of the film during a mortar attack on Sir James Bond's estate. That's Sir James Bond, played by David Niven. Now, John Huston is obviously the famous film director slash actor, sort of part of a big dynasty of actors, and he also directed this scene, or this part of Casino Royale, for, you know, a number of different reasons. But there was a few different directors on that film. But his sequence was that whole first bit with Sir James Bond meeting the representatives of the different agencies at the start of the film. And it was shot in Ireland and Kent in April 1966. It's got that weird bit where M is driving to Sir James Bond's estate and they pass some wild lions on their estate. It's very bizarre. So Huston worked on his section of the film with Wolf Mankiewicz, the man who had introduced Cubby and Harry to each other and had been loosely involved with the Bond films. But Huston had written a lot of the script himself, and he talking about comparing his previous film Beat the Devil to Casino Royale. He said that was discipline compared to this. It was day to day, but here it's moment to moment. So it sort of belies the sort of chaotic nature of the film there. So Huston actually wanted an actor called Robert Morley to play M, but he was unavailable. So he just stepped in and decided to play the role himself. And he said that the film was broached to me as a lark, which it was. And there's quite an interesting interview with Huston on Irish television that you can watch online. And he says, when he's asked about his version of M, he said, M is an absurd figure, as is everyone else in our film is absurd. And he says he shot his section of the film, the prologue, in Ireland, because that's where he lived. and that they found a better Scottish castle there than they could find anywhere in Scotland. And talking about the script and how it was working, he says that there has been some rewriting on the set. It's interesting that they asked him about this on set. It's clear that, you know, even at the time, people knew that there was like chaos going on behind the scenes. But he said there has been some rewriting on the set, but the atmosphere hadn't been frantic, but it was a lark. And so after Huston's M is killed in that section, David Niven's Sir James Bond comes the de facto M of the Secret Service, and that sort of kickstarts the events of the rest of the film. But he's always Sir James Bond from there on, so there's no real M moving forward in that movie. But that's really all there is to say about the Casino Royale version of M. He's not in it for very long. It's a bit different to what we know. Not a very memorable version, let's be honest.
The whole thing's a load of nonsense.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's hardly a hot take.
Yeah. Well, the people might be listening to this for the first time and going, oh, so I really want to find out more about it. These guys must love it.
Okay, well, I'll tell them they don't. Don't. So let's go back to some proper Bond. On the Majesty's Secret Service, 1969. So Bernard Lee continuing his stint. But this time we've got a slightly different interaction with the Bond, because it's George Lazenby, and we see two sides to him, don't we? Because we've got the he's quite terse with him, and he signs him off for 2 weeks, give him 2 weeks leave, but then when he gets married, he's there wishing him well. So we do get to see two sides of M again.
Well, he gets a bit more extreme, the two sides, as the films progress, don't they? Mm. Earlier on, it's just a little difference. And then, I mean, as it gets to Roger Moore films, it gets absolutely ridiculous.
But in this one, he really pushes Bond to his limits, doesn't he? Because this is the first film that Bond goes rogue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because of M.
Yeah. And obviously Bond goes rogue, and during that leave, he goes to M's house. He visits M, a scene that was shot in Marlowe in Buckinghamshire. And this is where we learn something that M likes to do outside of work. He's an amateur leopard stopped tourist. Oh dear, knew I was going to struggle with that. That is somebody who collects butterflies and puts them on display. And Bond, you really realise that from this point on, and especially the Roger Moore ones, but Bond being a bit of a smart ass towards M is really ramped up. In this, he comes in and he just says, he looks at the butterfly and says, unusually small for a Nymphalis polychloris. And obviously that winds M up because, you know, it's like, where does Bond's knowledge end on everything? Like, it's non-stop, isn't it? But interesting to see M outside of his usual habitat.
And interesting that his house, he has someone that answers the door for him, which I thought was quite fancy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice house.
He's got his own submarine.
Well, that's true.
Oh, yeah, good point. Lois Maxwell said on the set of this, she said he was drunk pretty much all the time, but you'd never know it. There was an incident during Honor Majesty's Secret Service in Portugal. He'd been drinking since about 9 a.m. George Lazenby was on a horse, and Bernard stuck a glass of wine under its nose. The poor thing reared up and kicked Bernard through some barbed wire. There was blood everywhere. The nearest thing there was to a doctor was a vet, who cut the loose flesh away with scissors and stitched Bernard's gashed leg.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he was still there on camera the same day. Amazing.
Absolute legend. We'll get that nowadays, would you?
And this is something that actually goes throughout. So he was a functioning alcoholic. And everyone who worked with him said how he could, you know, just the cameras would roll and he would be such a professional and he would be fantastic.
I think this gets worse and worse, though, doesn't it? I guess that that's the sad thing about his alcoholism.
Yeah. That's the problem. And fueled by tragedy as well. So 1972, just before Live and Let Die is beginning to shoot, he lost his wife in a house fire. So actor Jack Warner said Bernard and Gladys had a lovely 17th century cottage in Kent, and she died there tragically in a fire early in 1972. They were trapped in their bedroom when the fire started on the ground floor. Bernard escaped through a window, ran to get a ladder in an attempt to rescue her, but was unsuccessful. It was an awful end to a long and happy marriage. So he had to go to the hospital. He was hurt from that as well, and it put doubts over whether he would return for Live and Let Die. The same year, he was also mugged and robbed by two people. So after that, you know, he really did sort of ramp up the drink. He insisted on returning, and they did film their scenes, and it's actually a good interaction because this is where we get to go and see Bond's apartment this time, and Bond makes him that coffee and steals his spoon with the magnetic watch, again just infuriating M.
I always think with when M is working with Lazenby and Roger for the first time, it feels like they're taking too far. And because with Connery, he could get away with that because they'd built up that rapport, and you kind of knew he wasn't really annoyed. But when you see him with Lazenby, like, he is actually annoyed. He's actually annoyed of him. And the same with Roger, you think he really hates him. He doesn't want to work with him. Whereas because they've not built up that rapport yet.
Yeah. He even gets angry with him with the coffee machine, doesn't he? Is that all it does? It's like, well,
yeah, just constantly annoyed with him.
Just some interesting trivia for Live and Let Die is that, according to Roger Moore's diaries for Live and Let Die, you know, Bernard Lee was in such a bad way personally that they were, like you said, unsure that he was going to be able to do it. And Roger Moore's friend, Kenneth Moore, offered to do the role in Bernard Lee's place, and even offered to give the wages that he earned to Bernard Lee as a gesture of goodwill towards him. So, yeah, could have had a completely different M in Live and Let Die, but yeah, things changed. I guess that would have been a good time to swap him, but I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah, so obviously he goes on to continue playing M in Man with the Golden Gun, where he has a briefing at the beginning. Again, he asks Bond what he thinks of what he knows of Scaramanga, and what follows is Bond just unleashing all his knowledge, which is to a ridiculous level. Again, infuriating M.
Yeah, but normally, with the Connery relationship, by the end they're friends again, and but with the Roger Moore ones, he starts off annoyed with him, and by the end he's really annoyed with him because he's done something else annoying. I don't think at any point he likes him.
Yeah, because it's normally bookended with him doing something ridiculous at the end, isn't it? So 1975, Bernard Lee and Lois Maxwell, they played their Bond characters in a French Bond spoof called From Hong Kong with Love. Have you seen this?
Nope.
Or heard of it?
Nope.
No.
Never heard of it.
No. Well, it was.
Won't get that past the copyright laws these days, would you?
Exactly. 1977, so we've got The Spy Who Loved Me, and we see M and General Gogol briefing their agents. That's quite a good scene. He's obviously annoyed with him at the end.
Of course.
And at this point, Roger Moore says, Geoffrey Keane was cast as the defence minister in The Spy Who Loved Me and stayed for five more films. He actually became a bit of a minder to Bernie Lee, particularly when we were on location in Venice filming Moonraker. Bernie had a tendency to disappear to a bar and dear Geoffrey had to keep him out. So they basically got him a chaperone. It must have got quite bad at this point. And obviously his health was starting to deteriorate. So much so that Moonraker was actually his last one. Cubby really wanted him to come back and do Few Eyes Only, but he was well aware that his health was not in the right place. And he said, I'll come in and I'll test for you. And that was just to prove his point. So he was too weak. He couldn't do his lines, couldn't finish the scene. And Cubby reluctantly basically said, yeah, okay, I understand. But through respect, said that he won't be recasting straight away. Which means his scenes were actually split up, and we discussed this in the episode for Your Eyes Only. But they were split and given to Desmond Llewellyn and James Villiers, just to give his lines to someone else and not have to rest on another M straight away. Broccoli said he was a great personal friend, liked by all of us. His quiet authority and totally convincing manner were absolutely flawless. So, November 1980, he was admitted to hospital in London. He was suffering from stomach cancer. And on the 16th of January 1981, he died only 6 days after his 73rd birthday. He said about the role, M is the most enduring single running character I've ever played on stage or screen. He's been good to me and I wouldn't want to cross him. He has a built-in survival kit. Screen Bonds may come and go, but M seems to go on forever. There we go. Bernard Lee's M.
Well, we've talked about Bernard Lee. Now let's move on to the real big guns when it comes to M. We're talking Edward Fox as M in Never Say Never Again. Now, Edward Fox is actually been in quite a lot of stuff. He's actually quite a well-respected actor. I just don't remember him seeing him in many things. He comes from quite big sort of acting world stock. So his dad, Robin Fox, was a theatrical agent. His mother was Muriel Worthington, was an actress and a writer. And his elder brother is an actor called James Fox, and there's another one called Robert Fox, who's a film producer. And he is an uncle of Lawrence Fox. And also his paternal great-grandfather was an industrialist and inventor called Samson Fox. He was apparently quite famous for whatever he was he did. So
I already feel like this is too much.
I didn't do any research. I just thought that stuff was interesting because there's not much else that I've got to say about him. So in terms of his career, so his first film appearance was as an extra in The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, which was a really big film from 1962. And he worked a lot on stage in the 60s, including Hamlet. And after that, he worked in quite a lot of quite big films, in British films. So Oh, What a Lovely War, Battle of Britain, The Go-Between. And he won a BAFTA for Best Supporting Actor in The Go-Between. He was quite a respected actor. A director, Fred Zinnemann, was looking for somebody to be in his film The Day of the Jackal, which is a massive film.
Yeah.
And Fox got the role, and he beat people including Roger Moore and Michael Caine to the role, which is interesting, isn't it? From then on, he did quite a lot. He was in Bridge Too Far, and he won the Best Supporting Actor Award at the BAFTAs for that. He's in Force 10 from Navarone. We've spoke about that a few times in this podcast that had Robert Shaw and Harrison Ford in 1978. He was in Gandhi, and then he went on, that was in 1982, and then he goes on to play M in Never Say Never Again. And he is an interesting sort of M. It's they've definitely tried to do something removed from the canon series. And I watched a bit of it earlier, and it just doesn't quite work. They apparently that they were trying to cast him as a young technocrat, to contrast Bernard Lee, and also to parody Thatcher and her ministry budget cuts to government services. Yeah, he plays the role in there, but it's a very strange relationship between him and Connery, because there is no like love between the two. It's almost like Connery hates this guy for being sort of, you know, bureaucrat. He hates Connery because he's, I think Connery's grounded in it, isn't he? He's like a teacher of the 007s at this point.
Yeah.
And he wants to go out and actually do missions. This guy won't let him. He's got like, you know, he's like really tight. He's got budget cuts. It's just a strange scenario. I don't think it works. I see why they did it. I see that they wanted to sort of try something different, but you know, that's one of the fundamental things about Bond, that relationship between M and Bond. So, yeah, it just didn't work very well. I've not got a lot to say. He's not in it that much. I don't think he's a memorable M in any stretch of the imagination. I had to watch his scenes again just to remember what he was like. Definitely isn't one that sticks to memory. Other things he's been in after that, The Bounty, Wild Geese 2, Importance of Being Earnest, Nicholas Nickleby. And he does a lot of stage work as well, so some quite big things he does on stage. And interestingly, in 2002, apparently he joined the Countryside March to support hunting rights in the UK.
Of course,
you can boo that one.
Yep, boo.
Coffee, medium sweet. 2 medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a Ko-fi page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA-Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Coffee. Is that all it does?
Right, onto the big guns. Back to the other big dog in the world of M. Robert Brown. Now, he joined the James Bond films for 1977's The Spy Who Loved Me, playing Admiral Hargreaves. But after Bernard Lee's death, he was hired to play M in 1983's Octopussy. Because, as you said, the role of M had sort of been glossed over in For Your Eyes Only with James Villiers as Bill Tanner. Villiers apparently had hoped that he would stay on and become the new M, but Cubby and the producers thought he was probably a bit too young to play the M long term. Obviously with Roger not getting any younger either, I think it probably makes sense. So Robert Brown, talking about his initial meeting with Eon, he said he compared it to joining the military as a young man. He said, you just sat there and you were grilled. It was quite something, but I was fortunate because that afternoon they said, okay. So there is some discussion about Brown's incarnation of M. So some think, or there's a suggestion that he may just be the same M as Bernard Lee. There's a suggestion that he's a totally different M. There's also the suggestion that Hargreaves was promoted to be M. So the idea that Robert Brown's M is supposed to be the same M as Bernard Lee's M was put to bed with the release of No Time to Die, because both Bernard Lee and Robert Brown have portraits in MI6 headquarters, so it proves that they are separate people. The theory that Hargreaves had been promoted to M is a little bit more tenuous, because now this is a deep cut. In Spy Who Loved Me, Hargreaves has the insignia of a vice admiral, and in The Living Daylights, M has the insignia of a rear admiral, which suggests he would have had a demotion to become M. But actually, there is some... I'm boring myself here, but there is a suggestion that if you were to become the head of the Secret Service, that you would have to be demoted from being a vice admiral, because it's a lower paid position. But there you go. How boring. But you know, people do debate this stuff. So Brown's M is slightly more uptight than Bernard Lee's M, I think, and a little bit less tolerant of Bond's antics. Some interesting quirks with Robert Brown's M. He has a very impractical office in License to Kill. I don't know if you remember. In The Living Daylights. So at the very start of the film, he gives the secret agents their briefing, and then they jump out of the plane. And it turns out M's office is in the plane, and all the
classic 80s,
and all the paper like flies off his desk. And it's like, well, surely that happens quite a lot if you're on an aeroplane and they're opening the
paper. Does he look annoyed when they fly off the desk?
He does. Yeah. It's like, what were you expecting to happen? So there is.
Is there any point to him being in the plane?
No. I mean, it's a great opening scene, isn't it? I think it doesn't make any sense, but yeah, there was also that really great scene with Robert Brown's M in License to Kill at Hemingway's house. And Robert Brown said he enjoyed shooting his scenes in Key West, saying that for actors, this is a bonus. I guess for a jobbing actor like him, who probably just spends all his time at Pinewood and Shepperton, yeah, that is a huge bonus for him. Mm. So having worked with Roger Moore and then moving on to Timothy Dalton, he was a huge fan of Dalton. He called him a consummate professional. But yeah, looking back at his career, he was born in Dorset. There are conflicting reports of the year, but I'm going to go with 1918 that he was born. And he began his acting career, like many people of this era, after serving in the military during World War II. He served in the Royal Navy, so he was of naval heritage. And he had a very successful career as a TV and stage actor. So this is interesting, though, but he had a starring role in the 1950s TV series Ivanhoe, where he played Girth, the faithful companion of Roger Moore's Ivanhoe. So they had a long history together. He's just got tons of acting credits to his name. Some that you would have heard of include The Third Man, Helen of Troy, The Warriors, Ben-Hur, 300 Spartans, and 1 Million Years BC. So he ended his time in the Bond films with License to Kill. And his last acting credit only came a few years later in something called Marching Out of Time in 1993. He died in 2003, aged 85. So talking about his version of M, he said he's very much a Royal Navy product, but with an uncanny steeliness and resilience to run this business. He's got a personal feeling for his agents because, and although he is a toughie, he'll make decisions that will appall anybody. He is still worried about his people, which is a Royal Naval thing. So we end the Robert Brown era and move on to another M, which again complicates the idea of a continuous character somewhat.
Yes, it does. So in what was a change. There'd been a big gap. So Robert Brown had gone. And in real life, the head of MI5, the new head of MI5, Stella Rimington, was the first woman to be head of MI5. And that was in 1992. So during the time where they're writing GoldenEye and thinking of casting and where to go, they went and casted a woman. And Barbara Broccoli said, "Our instinct was if we're going to cast M as a woman, we needed to find an actress who would be totally believable and not cartoonish. Our fear that it would be laughable, and the big thing was to get someone the calibre of Judi Dench to play the role. And because M is the only authoritative figure in Bond's life, the casting of a woman as M gave the relationship a whole new dimension." In terms of now it seems like it makes sense. But back then, this was quite a big deal. And so that relationship from the outset in GoldenEye, you really see how little her opinion of Bond is. Call him a sexist, misogynistic dinosaur and nothing more than a relic of the Cold War, really setting a stall out there, not holding back.
It's one of those scenes that plays in the, the best of trailers, the montages. Yeah. It's an iconic Bond moment, isn't it now?
And the genius of it is it's a way for the writers to show their awareness of it as well, that this character is somewhat outdated. It's the 90s, we've moved on. The Cold War has finished. So it's really cleverly done, and a great way to introduce the first female M. And then moving on, she goes from strength to strength. The opening scene, Tomorrow Never Dies, where she works really well with Jeffrey Palmer. Of course, they'd work together on As Time Goes By. Yeah,
finally, we've got a reference to As Time Goes By.
That's just what you wanted, isn't it? And you can see from that she is concerned for Bond. That starts to creep in, because prior to that, you just thought that she was happy, and she said to him in GoldenEye, she was happy to just let him go and die. She doesn't care. It's just about getting the figures right and getting the job done. She has a much bigger role in The World Is Not Enough, and she assigns 007 to protect Elektra King, which he does. But then obviously it turns out that Elektra has turned and is actually is bad, and she kidnaps M, and then locks her up. So, in the tower. So M gets a meatier role in this, not just the briefing scene. And then again in Dying of the Day, she gets more of a scene. They get Bond out of captivity from North Korea, and she basically says that she should just let him die, just left him to die. So she's ruthless. She's not afraid to just say what she thinks.
Which is true to the character, I guess, isn't it? I guess
it is true to the character, yeah. But within that, you never think that she hates Bond. It's not a hatred. It's just it's just cold, isn't it? It's clinical. Yeah. And then obviously Brosnan departs from the role as Bond, and they do a soft reboot. And this is where it gets confusing, because they recast Judi Dench, and I tried to look and see why that was the case, and nothing other than it's Judi Dench and she was really popular in the role. There don't seem to be any other reason than that. I guess it's a good way to keep some continuity of the character from before.
Yeah, I feel like if they did it now, there would be more questions about it, because we're so used to this continuing narrative idea.
It wouldn't work now. It'd be ridiculous.
So I wonder...
Probably do it.
Yeah, I wonder whether it feels like they wouldn't do it with Ralph Fiennes in The Next Generation, but...
Yeah,
we'll come to that in a minute.
But in terms of whether it's the same M, again, it's unclear. She says in Casino Royale, "Christ, I missed the Cold War." Indicating that, she's been head of MI6 for some time, which we know she has in the world of Bond, but is this the same version? We don't know. It's not clear. But opens up all sorts of questions if it's not, or if it is. So it's best just to leave it. She's just M. So obviously Casino Royale is his first mission. So, she is still quite guiding him through. She says to him, any thug can kill. I need you to take your ego out of the equation. So she's, you know, he's still rough around the edges at this point. He breaks into her London apartment and also threatens to reveal her name, doesn't he? Is it this one?
Yes, he starts to say it, doesn't he?
Yeah, utter one more word and I'll have you killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then she continues to play M in Quantum of Solace, but Skyfall is where she really gets her... This is her moment.
You're not going to mention her high-tech office in Quantum of Solace?
What's that going to add?
Well, it's got all that stupid touchscreen, like, swishing stuff, isn't it? I just think it's a funny, weird version of MI6 in that film.
Yeah, probably based off the back of Minority Report.
Yeah.
That sort of nonsense. But we'll cover that in Quantum of Solace. Hold your horses. but Skyfall, that's where it all comes to a head. And she's targeted by former MI6 agent Raoul Silver. And because she turned him over to the Chinese government in order to save six others. So he is on a revenge mission. She goes to Skyfall with Bond and they set up loads of booby traps. She's shot, she's wounded, and then she dies in Bond's arms, making her the only M to die in the on Bond films on screen. So she actually makes her last appearance in Spectre in a brief cameo in a video of her will. And then in No Time to Die, there is a portrait of Judi Dench's M opposite a portrait of Robert Brown's M in Ralph Fiennes' office. So following her death in Skyfall, her name is revealed to be Olivia Mansfield.
Pointless.
Yeah, pointless. And that's for the duration of the Daniel Craig anyway. So that's the version of M. So she...
Okay, so...
Go on.
What, are you going to carry on?
Yeah.
Go on.
Well, you don't know anything about Judi Dench, do you?
Are you doing Judi Dench now?
Yes.
I thought you were...
When else are we going to do her?
Desperate to find. I thought you could do it at the start. You're just
prolonging the agony.
As long as you cover as time goes by.
Yes, I'm going to. Don't worry.
Excellent.
She said, "You always have to make a backstory for yourself in order to know how to react to certain things. I had this backstory with two grown-up daughters and everything. I knew her capabilities and I knew that she must have been through all sorts of things in order to get where she was to hold this job over lots of chaps at MI6. So I knew her capabilities. But I'm very glad they came to the fore." Sam Mendes said she was the first bona fide great actor that I worked with. "I learned more from watching her, the way she worked, than I ever had before." So Judi Dench, she was born in York, 9th of December 1934. And one of her first acting jobs was as Mary in a York mystery play. There's a bench in York next to the river. And it annoys me that they've not called it
Dench Bench, or
Judi Bench. Yeah, it's got her name on it, but they haven't called it
Public Dench.
Yeah, just they could have done loads of that, and they've not bothered.
Wasted opportunity.
Yeah,
the Bench of Dench. I mean, it writes itself, doesn't it?
It does exactly. So she went to Central School of Speech and Drama in London, and she made a professional debut in 1957 at the Old Vic, where she established a career. Joined up with the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford. Her first TV appearance was in a show called ITV's Play of the Week in the episode Family on Trial in 1959 with Bernard Lee. So there's a nice link there. So 1965, she won a BAFTA for Most Promising Newcomer in a film called Four in the Morning. Then she carves out an amazing theatre career in acclaimed performances of Midsummer Night's Dream, which was also on screen, opposite Diana Rigg in that, so another Bond alumni. And then her acting career is, like, it's relentless.
Massive, yeah.
Yeah. Her Lady...
If you want to make a good film, get the Dench in.
Get the Dench in, yeah. Her Lady Macbeth is renowned. It's one of the best versions of Lady Macbeth ever. It was directed by Trevor Nunn, opposite Ian McKellen. That's in the late 70s. Then in the 90s, as time goes by, which ran from 92.
Whee!
That's two lovers who meet again after 38 years have passed, co-starred with Jeffrey Palmer.
What I find funny about as time goes by is that back in those days, when you watch these shows, they're meant to be about old people.
Yeah.
Like the Waiting for God and all those ones. You look back now, they weren't that old.
No. Well, she's 86 now, isn't she? So,
yeah.
What's that? That's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So she has been nominated for an Academy Award 8 times. She won it for Best Supporting Actress for a performance as Queen Elizabeth I in Shakespeare in Love. She was only on screen for 8 minutes.
Fantastic in that film. Fantastic.
She was nominated for Mrs. Brown, Chocolat, Iris, Mrs. Henderson Presents, Notes on a Scandal, Philomena and Belfast. She's also won a BAFTA Fellowship Award, Society of London Theatre Special Award and the British Film Institute Fellowship Award. She is probably one of the most decorated actors ever. If not...
She's a license to print quality.
Okay, I don't know what you're doing. In terms of her personal life, she married Michael Williams in 1971, and they were together until he died in 2001. And they had a daughter together, Finty Williams, who is also an actor. She was given an OBE in 1970, and then a Dame Commander of the British Order of the British Empire in 1988. So she's been a Dame for a long time, as well.
Yeah.
And then recently, it was announced October 2021, she was be joining the cast of Alleluia, an adaptation of Alan Bennett's play. That's alongside Jennifer Saunders, Russell Tovey, David Bradley and Derek Jacobi. So she's still plugging away. And I think her playing M really brought an air of quality to Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was probably one of the first of the big actors to be in it. I mean, in the later films, they do sort of pick up more classic actors. But yeah, she's definitely sort of defined it. She's one of the pillars of British institutions, isn't she? Like her, Stephen Fry.
Ian McKellen.
Like, yeah. Ian McKellen. Like they're all of those ones that, you know, when they pop off, we should get a day of memorial for them because it'd be so sad when they go. But yeah, fantastic. Who?
Mirren.
Yeah, Mirren, yeah.
Kane.
Yeah. Okay, all right. What's going on?
These are the actors we deserve days off for.
That's a different podcast.
What about Ralph Fiennes? Does he not deserve it?
Eventually. He's not there
well,
yet.
Well, speaking of Ralph Fiennes, he also played M. I'm going to do this the other way around than you, as I always do, because I want to get the background done first, so then we can talk about Bond. So, very much like Judi Dench, Fiennes is a much revered actor with many accolades to his name, many fantastic films, and I think it's safe to say he is a very classically trained actor who's done a lot of impressive stage work as well. But he comes from a family of actors or people that work in the movies, so there's no surprise that he was going to do that. So he's the eldest of 6 children. Some of his siblings include Joseph Fiennes. Martha Fiennes is the director, in which he played the main role in her film Onegin. Magnus Fiennes, who's a composer. Sophie Fiennes, who's a filmmaker. And and Jacob Fiennes, who's a conservationist. But also, I felt this is an...
You haven't given his full name.
Who?
Ralph Fiennes.
Go on then, give his full name.
Ralph Nathaniel... Twizzleton Wycombe Fiennes.
Twizzleton?
Yes.
That's a fantastic name. Mm,
isn't it?
I'm writing that one down if I have kids. But also, one interesting fact I found out about him, well, not necessarily about him, but his nephew, Hero Fiennes...
Tiffin. Yes.
He plays Tom Riddle
in
Harry Potter series, the young Voldemort, so... Interesting fact for you Harry Potter fans out there who also like Bond. So he went on to... I'll skip some of the sort of stuff he did at school and things, but he went to RADA as well between 1983 and 1985. And his career started in the Open Air Theatre, Regent's Park, as well as the National Theatre. And then he joined the Royal Shakespeare Company. So he was off to a pretty good start for where acting is concerned. He worked on his film debut was he played Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights, opposite Juliette Binoche. But it wasn't until 1993 where things really started to kick into gear and he shot into stardom at a ridiculous level. So his first thing was The Baby of Macon with Julia Ormond. Although that film didn't do that well, apparently it provoked quite a bit of controversy. But the film that really shot him to stardom was Schindler's List, where he played Amon Goth, who's obviously the evil Nazi concentration camp commander. It's fantastic in that film. It's an amazing film to have at the start of your career. He was also in Quiz Show. I think Quiz Show is probably... I don't remember Quiz Show very well, but I associate it with him very closely. I can see that when I think about his filmography. That was in 1994. And probably one that everyone would associate with him, The English Patient in 1996. And he was nominated for Best Actor Academy Award for that film. He was in Red Dragon in 2002. And The Constant Gardener, great film. And he also voiced Lord Victor Quatermain in Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. Didn't know that.
Yep. What do you want? What do you want from us?
I was waiting for you to go, really?
Nope.
But then his sort of mainstream popularity shot through the roof when he became Voldemort in 2005 in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Yeah, so he's had just a ridiculous career. The Duchess, In Bruges, Clash of the Titans, probably not one that he mentions very often. Okay, so in 2012, he finally joined the Bond series he didn't join as M originally because Judi Dench was M in that film. So he actually joined as Mallory, who is like he works alongside MI6 and the British government as a sort of intermediary to check what MI6 is doing, and you know, sort of bureaucratic role of making sure that they're not going out of, they're not doing things they shouldn't do, and sort of controlling it, a bit of a watchdog. And because of that role, he's not a very likable character at the start. And in some ways, you kind of think he might actually be the villain. So in Skyfall, he actually starts off as Mallory, and we don't know he's M or going to be M until right at the end of the film. And I actually found, I think that's done quite well in Skyfall, because I think there are points where I sort of suspected it, but because the previous films didn't really have Moneypenny in, there was already an M, I didn't really think, put two and two together. I was thinking that might happen, but it didn't. So it was a nice twist at the end, and it works quite well. And he does have an interesting character arc, because you don't like him early on because he's this sort of bureaucratic, he's trying to stop them saving the world basically by using, you know, governmental tactics just to sort of say you shouldn't be doing these things.
Red tape, isn't it?
Within the rules. Sorry?
Just red tape.
He's just red tape, yeah. And you don't like him because of that. And also, the way that the film's going, there are bits where you kind of think, is he one of the baddies? Is he actually in cahoots with the baddies? So it's quite a nice story arc. And he eventually, throughout the film, he doesn't sort of redeem himself right until the end, where he comes out of his sort of red tape role and he becomes sort of a hero figure alongside them and helps them out. I wouldn't say he's like, you know, you don't necessarily really like him at that point. You just say, oh, there's more to this character. And then it's a really nice hit at the end of the film when you see it and you go, ah, okay, that's good. I get it now. It's nice to see an origin for an M, and it's done very well, I think. That's one of the nicest features of that, of Skyfall. I think they really pull that together nicely. Over the course of the next two films, so Inspector, he has a significantly more... he's quite a big role in Skyfall, but in Inspector, he... A bit like Judi Dench in World Is Not Enough and Skyfall, he's one of the main characters. He's part of the main team, and he's actually on the ground getting involved, and he's got a gun now and stuff like that. And he's not that... He must be around the same age as Craig as well. So I think there's one point where they have a discussion where it kind of says to him, you thought I was just a desk jockey or something like that. But he's obviously a military man. He's trained. He can do all this stuff as well. So he's just sort of an equivalent to Craig. And I think that earns him Craig's respect in that film as well. So I think I'd probably argue that Mallory as M has probably got one of the best story arcs in the whole Craig series, because he does develop over time quite nicely. Does get a bit silly when it gets to No Time to Die, because we've spoken about this many times, where they form the, what do we call them, like the Scooby-Doo crew or something like that, where those the four people work together and they solve all the world's problems. There's like
the mystery gang
group. The mystery gang, yeah. And that does get a bit ridiculous. I think he loses a little bit of his, what's the word, gravitas,
yeah,
in,
yeah,
No Time to Die. And you think, well, maybe just, you know, sit behind your desk,
yeah,
and get some other people to do this. You have other people. So yeah, so by the end of it, he's been there throughout that No Time to Die series until the film, until he dies at the end. And the last time we see M is when he's taking a toast to the spoiler dead Bond at the end.
Spoiler, you've spoiled after you've spoiled.
So they're the films that he's in. Interestingly, I read something about Fiennes is the youngest actor ever to play M, because he was 49 when he first appeared in the role, which makes me think that he might even, yeah, maybe Craig was about 46 or something about that time. Need to check that up, but they're a very similar age. On getting the role, he said that he was actually, interestingly, he said that he'd previously spoken to Barbara Broccoli about playing Bond at one point, which you can imagine, can't you? He's a famous British actor of a certain age, yeah, that has, you know, he fits the role perfectly. He probably would have been an interesting Bond. But he did say something interesting about Spectre with Sam Mendes, and he said that originally they wanted, they were looking at the idea of M, or Mallory's M, turning into a bad guy in that film. So in Spectre, there's a lot of sort of back and forth, isn't there? There's times where you're not, you think, oh, maybe he's the guy doing this, he's behind it all, which would have been an interesting, it wouldn't have been past that film to make that twist.
Yeah.
It seems pretty conceivable at that point. But that various people, I imagine, said no, but definitely Fiennes was not up for that. And he said that M should never be a bad guy. So they had some pretty big discussions about that, and he said, it's just not flying with me. If it was like he was Blofeld or something, but that was a red line in that idea. So yeah, so that's Fiennes. That's his journey of Bond. I think he's very good. So yeah, after Bond, he continues to be very prolific in the acting world. He was in the Grand Budapest Hotel. He's also in a Coen Brothers film, Hail Caesar.
He's great in that.
And yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah. And then probably the finest part of his career, in 2017, he voiced Alfred Pennyworth in the Lego Batman movie.
Ah, yes.
And came back for Lego Movie 2, the second part, in 2019. He also voiced a tiger in Doolittle, starring Robert Downey Jr. in 2020. And yeah, he's got lots of projects coming up, including Wes Anderson's The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which should be a blast when it comes out. The other thing you should say about Fiennes is he's also a UNICEF UK ambassador, and he's done a lot of work in India, Kazakhstan, Uganda and Romania. And he's also a member of the Canadian charity Artists Against Racism. So yeah, Fiennes, big name, definitely one of the defining M's for me. And yeah, I think he's definitely don't. Well, what do you guys think? Could he come back?
He could.
I think he could, but I don't think he needs to. It feels like it's just, that's it. It's a nice little package. It's all done.
Yeah.
Might be confusing if he does.
Yeah.
Interesting that I don't think without Judi Dench, we would have got a Ralph Fiennes caliber actor in the role, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They realised that was important and it worked. So
yeah, I guess it's whether or not that remains to be the case in the next incarnation. I feel like maybe again they've painted themselves into a corner slightly by casting such high calibre.
Get Myers in.
Myers, Mike Myers.
Yeah.
As a spoof. Talking of which, let's talk about other versions of M. We haven't got Alan Porter of the Bond Lexicon here to talk about all the myriad versions of Bond of M, but there are obviously countless versions of them of M in the books. There is one in the Raymond Benson's book, another female M whose name is Barbara Maudsley, and M actually gets their own Dynamite comic, a one shot about M's past. Which goes back to Northern Ireland, I think, and the troubles in Ireland, but in Belfast. That's one version. But one version of M that I thought was really interesting is a version that crops up in Alan Moore's comic, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, in which a character called Campion Bond recruits the team of extraordinary individuals on behalf of the head of British intelligence, M. And Campion is said to be the grandfather of James Bond that we know in our version of the of reality. But M in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen transpires to be Moriarty, Sherlock Holmes's nemesis. Mm. And after Moriarty is defeated in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Mycroft Holmes becomes the new M. And then in later versions of that comic, other M's in the series include Harry Lime from The Third Man and Emma Peel from The Avengers. So that was quite interesting. Mm. But yeah, what's the future for M? We talked about it at length with Moneypenny. I still think there's it's a role that has to be played within the world of Bond, I think.
Go back to basics. Simplify it. Go back to just in a room, plays the fatherly role or whatever, and that's the only time you see him. Don't try and drag him into the main plot.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely.
Or her,
yeah.
I agree. Yeah.
Don't overcomplicate it. I think when you overcomplicate it, then it just becomes hard to maintain, doesn't it? That's the issue. It's how do you keep that going through a series of films? M should be, well, you know, keep it, like you say, keep it simple. Who would you like to see play the next M? I've got a few names I'd like to suggest.
Go on then.
Jared Harris.
Yes, I can definitely see that.
I think he'd be good. He plays military types, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's got Steely Reserve. He's of a similar ilk to, you know, Judi Dench, Robert Brown. He's in he's 60, I think, so he's the right age for M next.
Have you got Ken Branagh in there?
Ken Branagh was literally the next name on the list.
He would love it.
He could direct it as well.
So. Yeah, love to see Ken Branagh doing a Bond film. Ian McShane.
Yeah, I'm not having that.
Bit too old. And then not the right
ilk either.
No, and then one I've suggested in the past, but Idris Elba.
Yeah, but the problem is with that, they would definitely get him in the field.
Right.
They couldn't resist that. They couldn't stick him behind a desk. They'd need him out there helping Bond.
In the first film, maybe, and then if he gets injured in the you know, Bond has to save him, and then that becomes their relationship.
No, because then he'll get injured, and then Q will make him like a magic eye or something. You know it'll happen. It just becomes Avengers.
Fair enough. Yeah. Have you got any suggestions?
Well, Ken Branagh would be where I would have gone with that, so I'm glad he's on your list.
Ken Branagh's a great choice, yeah. I'd definitely see that work. In the style of Bond that we've been talking about recently, I think he would work very well.
And he plays an admiral, naval commanding officer in Dunkirk, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Very well.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
So he's got heritage.
Could be a bit Poirot as well.
Yeah, he's got a big moustache, yeah.
He could play it as Poirot. Do that, it's fine. Have fun with it.
Go crazy. Have a few years, a bit of fun, mate. Go for it.
Well, I think we should wrap things up there. So thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast, please leave us a good review or rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. As you've heard from the adverts throughout the show, you can support us online at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA to Z, where you can buy us a coffee, which we will spend on Kenneth Branagh videos.
Videos?
Yeah.
And you can buy an M jumper, can't you?
You can. There is now an M jumper, an M t-shirt.
Now, is that for M or is that for the letter M?
It could be either, doesn't it?
It could be for whatever you want it to be.
Interesting.
Mother. The song Mm-mm-mm by Crash Test Dummies, if you're a big
fan.
You got it in there,
didn't you?
I mean, it definitely doesn't work when you've just got one M.
But if you get a line of the people wearing them. 16 of them. Yeah. And if people want to send in their suggestions for who they want to hear as a play as M, where should they send them to?
Okay, podcast@jamesbond.co.uk.
And if you want to get us on social medias, Brendan?
@jamesbond.co.uk on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter.
And before you do sign off, I have just remembered, so I don't get any complaints from Ralph Fiennes fans, he was also obviously in Kingsman, which has links to a Bond-style character.
Yes, good point.
Haven't forgot that one.
That's a good save there, that is.
That's a good catch, yeah.
Don't want any more emails.
No. But yeah, thank you very much for listening. Our next episode, we will finally finish the letter M. I mean, it's been as long as the letter C, this one, hasn't it?
Yes.
But we'll finally get to the end of the letter M with an episode on Moonraker, which is an absolutely massive movie. And I feel like it's going to be a bit of a...
Just get me to N for Never Say Never Again.
And then, yes, we'll be moving on to N, Never Say Never... And No Time to Die, obviously, you're... in for a treat in the next few weeks. So with that, it just remains for me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Ta-ra.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
You don't like me, Bond. You don't like my methods. You think I'm an accountant. A bean counter, more interested in my numbers and your instincts.
The thought had occurred to me.
Good. Because I think you're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur. A relic of the Cold War. Whose boyish charms, though wasted on me, obviously appeal to that young woman I sent out to evaluate you.
Point taken.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.